What more can we say? Thelonious Monk, Ray Copeland, G.G. Grice, Coleman Hawkins, John Coltrane, Wilbur Ware, Art Blakey. All on the Riverside label. Going all the way back a long, long ways, 1957. And the individual here that made it all possible will be with us in a moment. And the Live with the Jazz Cat show is just about to be on the air on For Locals Only. So stay right here. Promises to be a terrific interview. Stay right here on Caramel Jazz and Blues Radio. I'm Gary Hamada. With any bit of luck, we always seem to be able to get a hold, or he gets a hold of us, the Jazz Cat himself, Leroy Downs. I hope you had a chance to meet him over there in the Monterey Jazz Festival, holding court at Dizzy's Den, as he normally does every year. But today he's on his show, Live with the Jazz Cat, and it's airing right here on For Locals Only on Caramel Jazz and Blues Radio. He has a legendary figure with him today, and I won't spoil the introduction because this man deserves all the respect that he can garner for him. And I tell you what, I don't call everybody Mister, but in this particular case, I hold him in such reverence. I listened to the recordings for so many years as I went to UC Berkeley, and I won't steal the thunder any longer. Let's, without further ado, bring on the host of the Live with the Jazz Cat show, Leroy Downs. Hi, Leroy.
Hey, Gary, how you doing?
Hey, I tell you what, you keep doing it over and over every week.
Well, you know,
the luminaries.
You got to bring on all the legends of the business. This happens to be one of my heroes, and I know you didn't spoil it for me, and people are wondering after you played Thelonious Monk. Well, no, I did not resurrect Thelonious Monk, but we have Mr. Oren Keep News on the line. Hey, Oren.
Hey, good to be here, and as long as you emphasize that I'm a living legend, I'll allow myself to be called that.
Well, you're a living legend and one of my heroes. For many of you, I shouldn't even say for many of you who don't know, but if you know jazz, you know Riverside Records, you know Mr. Oren Keep News. Now, Oren, I mentioned this to you many times before, and I'll say it again, you are one of my biggest heroes, and when I first started out in jazz radio, one of my greatest discoveries was that when you go into the library and you look at the spine of the records, if it says Riverside Records, you'd be guaranteed that the music is superb, and your name was on every one of those albums.
Well, you know, you also have to look at the other side of that picture. We had, almost a dozen good years, but at the end of that time, the practicalities of life kind of wiped us out.
Yeah, well, you know, this is jazz music, and it seems like all of us who love dedicating our lives to this music have to suffer some way. I don't understand why. We should be celebrated, not suffering, but Riverside is certainly a legendary jazz label and continues to be so.
Well, I was involved long enough so that there was absolutely no hope of my escaping back into any kind of a normal life. I have been, you know, under other auspices and in other circumstances since then, but during what I have to realize is slightly over 40 years since the end of the original Riverside adventure, I'm still functioning. And I don't know how about anybody else feels about that, but it scares the hell out of me.
Well, it makes us happy. You know, you were on the scene when the music of the 50s and 60s was just so innovative and, you know, literally put a stamp on an era of creativity that has changed the world and how we listen to music to this day.
You know, I have to wonder sometimes if we knew how immortal we were going to turn out to be, would we have been able to pull it off, or would we have been too self-conscious about the whole thing?
Yeah, that's a wonder, but I'm sure that you would have had no problem at all pulling it off. You know, what was the inception of Riverside Records? I mean, how did you go about starting a record company and then proceed to record some of the most legendary players in the world?
Well, actually, Riverside started off as a reissue label because the two people who started it, myself and a man named Bill Grauer, we were both traditional jazz fans. We had first met each other when we were undergraduates at Columbia, the university, not the label, back in New York. After the late lamented World War II, that old war that's now being made famous all over again by Ken Burns, but after that we were back in the campus area, and he soon became the owner of a very small, very esoteric magazine called The Record Changer, which was mainly, that title is pretty much a pun, if you can remember. Those of us who know back to the 78 RPM days, a record changer was a device that enabled you to have automatically go from one record to the next. And the title of the magazine also referred to the fact that it was had a very complicated mail order auction situation, so that people were exchanging records through the magazine. At the time, I just started on what I thought was my career. I was working as a very young editor at a book publisher in New York. That meant that I was sort of like the only officially literary or officially literate person that Grauer knew, and he asked me to be the editor of the magazine. That led me to some dreadful situations. I want to say that it's not necessarily true now, but it sure was true at that point, that being a jazz enthusiast didn't automatically make anybody a decent writer. So some of the most painful and painstaking editing in my life was done in preparing other people's articles for that magazine. But the good part was that whatever I wanted to write, there wasn't anybody whose permission I had to get. I just went ahead and did it, and I authorized me to do it. The first really serious result of that situation was that I was in a position to write and then to, with no problem, publish an interview with this not quite obscure, but not far from it, new piano player on the scene, a man who had just made his very first records for Blue Note, and that was this piano player named Thelonious Monk.
Now, you met Thelonious at, Alfred Lyons.
That's what it was all Alfred Lyons doing. Alfred, who, of course, was, in a sense, the originator, or almost the originator of the concept of the independent jazz label. Blue Note was actually at that time, we're talking 1947-48, Blue Note was just in the process of switching over. Blue Note had begun very much as a traditional jazz label, and it was in the process of starting to investigate modern jazz and some of the people that were described under that term. And so he was starting to record people like Tad Dameron and Monk, and I guess they were kind of afraid, because Monk hadn't been that much heard, but definitely already had a reputation of being incredibly difficult and peculiar. And, you know, and any of those words that you want to get in there with. So what happened was, literally, this was the very beginning of the Record Changers' adventures under Grauer and Keepnews. We had started with an editorial in which we said that, unlike the previous operators of this magazine, we were not going to be strictly high-bound, conservative, traditional types, but we were going to be open to any kinds of good music. And I don't think I knew what the hell I was talking about when I wrote that, but it was taken very seriously by, most importantly, by this young man who was newly the founder of Blue Note Records. So we got a phone call from Alfred Lion, who we knew but not very well, inviting us to come down to a gathering at his home, and among other things, to meet Monk. And he just like me to follow up on our general statement by exposing us to Monk. I actually had not heard at all in any way. I hadn't heard Thelonious until that evening. And what I heard that evening was there were test pressings on hand of the first couple of records that he had done for Blue Note, which weren't quite released yet. But I sat there and I listened to these things, and I was an instant convert.
Now, from what I understand, during that time that you met Monk, you spoke with him that evening, and you did an interview with him. And
actually, with an attitude that I have subsequently taken to describing as the arrogance of ignorance. I didn't know any better. I just kind of pulled him off into a corner in this big Greenwich Village living room. And in the somewhat semi-private atmosphere there, I proceeded to take care of business. I assumed that, hey, I'd been asked to be there in order to perhaps be able to come up with, magazine publicity for the man. I certainly liked the first taste I had of his music, and I proceeded, I went right ahead and interviewed him. Now, it wasn't until later that I discovered you weren't supposed to be able to do that. I mean, I really didn't know that he was supposed to be quite so hard to get at and quite so non-talkative, as a result of which I didn't have any problems in talking with him.
Well, that's what happens. When you don't know, it keeps it fresh, and you're able to get across what you need to without having all of that, oh, this is Thelonious, I don't want to be scared to talk to Thelonious.
Yeah, well, they had already started working on his High Priest of Bop type reputation. He was that... That nickname for him had already been created, but I didn't know enough to be scared by that. And also, one thing that's important, and it kind of fits in with the who was playing on that, on the record that you were introduced with there. But the drummer on Monk's first Blue Note session was Art Blakey. And I've always felt that one of the reasons why I got so strongly turned on to Monk so quickly was that, I've always felt, and I rather think that Monk generally agreed, with all due respect to some of the other great players of the period, Blakey was the ideal drummer for Thelonious.
Yeah.
And he gave a quality to those first couple of numbers that I don't think necessarily would have been there. I think the combination of Blakey's approach, which was, in many ways, Blakey was a great communicator, and the combination of that kind of managed to soften down all the hard edges, not all the hard edges, but enough of the Monk hard edges, so that it began to be something that you could listen to.
You're listening to the Godfather of Jazz, Mr. Orrin Keaton, who's right here on the show live with the Jazz Cat. My name is Leroy Downs, and you're listening to it on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. Well, Thelonious, you spoke about his rise, and he's become one of the few iconic figures that we call by first name only. First name or last name, doesn't matter. We know who he is. And not everyone, at first got a chance to recognize his genius, but certainly they did afterwards. And you spent a great amount of time with Monk and successfully had a strategy for popularizing his music when he came over to Riverside. And, of course, Sonny's recent success at that time didn't hurt either.
Hmm. Well, the thing is that one thing that's important is that you know, this was not an immediate follow-through. I'm talking about meeting him, doing an interview which was published in the spring of 1948 in what I knew damn well to be an obscure magazine, and in it I was very frank about my enthusiasm for Monk, but I had no immediate further contact with him. First of all, I was not in the music business. This was something I was sort of dabbling with as a sideline. I was working, as I say, in the book business, and Monk was not particularly, or nothing particularly was happening with Monk. He was, at the time, he had, through some pretty strange circumstances, had his cabaret card taken away, and the cabaret card in those days was a very important thing. It was in effect, a police department issued card out which you could not perform in any place that was selling liquor, which kind of ruled out any place that might be at all likely to hire a jazz musician.
Exactly.
So it was, at the time, Monk had a couple of records out. He played in a couple of other cities, but nothing terribly much was happening with his career. So actually, what happened with Monk is he kind of went through almost all the available changes in the independent jazz scene. He did work for Blue Note, of course, and nothing much happened. And finally, he and Blue Note parted company. He was signed to Prestige, and nothing very much was happening for him there. And Prestige at this time, we're now into the early 50s, and Prestige is concentrating on some pretty hot artists they've got there, like the Modern Jazz Quartet, and like Miles Davis, and such. And the other thing that had happened was that Rauer and I had decided to start a label. So Riverside came into existence, and as I say, it was initially a reissue label, a traditional label. And then we decided that we wanted to move ourselves into the current scene. And I mean, frankly, I was starting to listen to the jazz that was going on around me and found myself very much taken by it and very interested in it. And if we were going to be a label, let's be a meaningful label.
Right.
So that then the next fateful accident or incident is I got a phone call from a critic who was not particularly a friend of mine, but I guess he was trying to show off at the time. I knew him, so I got a phone call from Nat Hentoff tipping me to the fact that Prestige and Monk were mutually very unhappy with each other, and that the way he heard the story, it would take very little to be able for Monk to be able to get out of his Prestige contract, that they would be kind of happy to get rid of him. So I got a hold of Monk and invited him to come to our offices for a meeting. And then I started to get scared about, was, now at this point, we're in 1953. 5 years have gone by since I wrote this piece about him. And I'm starting to, you know, he's supposed to be some kind of a nut, and he is a jazz musician, and is he even going to remember this occasion or this article? So I was pretty nervous about that aspect of it. But to my great surprise, when I, when Monk appears at the office, and I start to do a "Do you remember?" kind of bit, and he shuts me up real fast. He knows exactly who I am. I'm the guy, according to him, that wrote the first article about Monk ever to appear in a national magazine. He was well aware of the fact that it had been not only a very favorable article, but that I had compared him. What I had said was I felt that Monk was sort of like the next link in a chain that goes back to Jelly Roll Morton and continues through Duke Ellington.
Right.
Well, it also turned out that comparing Monk to Duke Ellington was a very nice thing from his point of view for me to have done. But anyway, we had a situation where instead of Monk not knowing, Monk did know and was pretty impressed. I mean, he started off with a favorable feeling. There's also the fact, and I have to admit, that having gone through Blue Note and having been, he was aware that he was pretty much at the end of his line, at the end of his rope as far as prestige was concerned, it wasn't all that adventurous for Monk to decide to take a chance with this relatively new, young label, because how many chances were there out there for him?
Well, you did a good thing. You compared him to the
Well, and then, of course, the thing is that the first thing that we had in mind when he agreed to come with us, the major point was, how do you make this man more accessible to a wider audience than he's been able to have so far? And the first plot that we came up with was kind of double-edged. The first thing was not to have him do a whole program of his rather difficult original compositions, but to have him work with standard material. And then, secondly, to keep those intrusive bebop horns out of the picture, at least to begin with. Monk himself was difficult enough. He didn't need one of them crazy trumpet players in addition. The letter A is followed by the letter B, and my first suggestion to Monk is, how about if we do a trio album of entirely consisting of Ellington material? Now, looking back on it, I got to figure the first time I dropped a repertoire suggestion on this man, he said yes immediately. I didn't know what kind of odds I'd been working against. As I got to know him better, I knew how unusual that was. But, there's something wonderful about being young and naive and not knowing a damn thing about the business that you're in, which was exactly my condition then. I didn't know enough to be afraid.
Hey, well, that's what made it all happen, because had you known enough, then you would approach him a different way.
I approached him as, hey, I know your material well enough to think that this is a good idea. How about it? And then, of course, the other thing was that we decided we're going to do this thing, we're going to do it in the classiest way possible. So the first thing was, was a combination of saying to him, hey, you can work with anybody you want, but kind of pushing for top of the line, so that that trio on that first Monk Plays Ellington record just simply merely consisted of Oscar Pettiford and Kenny Clarke. Which is a pretty bright way to go.
I agree. I know we only have, I've kind of gone over my time with you on the air. I know Gary has to get to other things on the air. I would love to talk to you all day long, but
it doesn't take much for me to talk all day long. But I think if I was able to tell you the story of how Monk came into my life and I came into his, I've done a good enough job that I will have no objections to your shutting me up now. It's, I can't even say it's been a pleasure talking to you, because all you did was introduce me and step out of the way. But thank you for that.
Hey, man, well, you know, when you talk, you are history, man. So when you talk, I listen. So we certainly appreciate you.
Well, I certainly hope that's true of your listeners too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, it's been my pleasure to snow you under with my nonstop talk.
Hey, we'll have to have another discussion another time again.
Okay, sir.
Orrin Keep News right here on Live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. My name is Leroy Downs, and you're listening to the For Locals Only show with Gary Hamada.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. Really a pleasure to have such a legend, living legend, as he calls him, Orrin Keep News. Listened to Orrin quite a bit. Actually, everything he did back in the late 60s, early 60s. 64 was my first year at Cal Berkeley, and of course, he's at 10th and Parker in Berkeley. Just to give you an idea, there were three legendary post-war labels, Blue Note, Prestige, and Riverside. Riverside being kind of the little brother of them all, but turns out that out of those trio, there was a decade from 1952 to 64 that really Orrin Keep News initiated and developed the careers of some remarkably significant major artists. And we'll be playing some of those over the next week or so on the Riverside Jazz label. Again, thank you to Leroy, the Jazz Cat Downs, for bringing to the airwaves, again, Orrin Keep News. As you can tell, Orrin is a very engaging conversationalist as well as an individual, has a lot to say, and hope to have him back on again very soon. We'll be right back with a lot more on KRML Jazz and Blues Radio. Let's play a little bit of Riverside recording. Of course, Blue Monk is a classic, and that is a Thelonious Monk composition. This is certainly a classic only because it's always unaccompanied piano solo. This was recorded in San Francisco October 21st of 1959 on the Riverside Jazz label.